Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Welcome to as close to fresh baked as you're ever going to get in a podcast. Today's interviewee on the SBGAN podcast is Dr. Elena Sarnat. She trained in part in Cluj-Napoca, otherwise known to this new Hungarian as Golosvár. Then after 3 years there, on an Erasmus scholarship, transferred herself to Valencia. And there she finished her training. Her pediatrics work, all over the world practically, but now she lives and works in Leeds. And we have managed to convince her to go through the abstract booklet of the SBGAN annual meeting, the 58th annual meeting, which very recently ended in Lille. She has selected six abstracts, and she has opinions. She definitely has opinions, and she's going to share them with us. You picked out six abstracts from two from each of three fields, and nutrition, hollow viscous work, and the liver. How did you pick out these six?
Hi, Alex. It's really wonderful to be back for another SBGAN annual meeting podcast. And this year we had another exceptional congress, the biggest until now, with over 6,000 participants. As always, SBGAN annual meeting continues to be an amazing event, bringing together thousands of clinicians, researchers, allied health professionals, industry partners from more than 100 countries. The meeting is an incredible opportunity to share cutting-edge science, discuss the latest clinical advances, and explore innovations that have the potential to transform the care of our patients. What I particularly admire about SBGAN, and probably I'm saying this every year, it's its constant commitment to education and innovation. Once again, the program was packed with opportunities to learn, to connect, including plenary lectures, interactive workshops, learning zones, specialized courses in PIGAN, PIBD, artificial intelligence, real case discussion, joint symposium, and extensive research presentation. But most important, it gave us the opportunity to come together as a global community with a shared mission: advance science and continuously improve the care of infants and children worldwide. And about the abstract, it's not an easy task to choose them. It's so difficult. There are so many good studies over there, but...
Well, let's start with your particular interest or specialty, which is nutrition. I'm going to ask you, in presenting these abstracts, just to give the titles, for those listening at home, the abstract booklet, and the abstracts, of course, will be available at some point in SBGAN. But for those of you who want to look up the authors, for those of you who want to seek out other work by those authors, the précis that at the website accompanies this podcast will contain the details on those institutions and those authors.
Thank you. So the first one from Nutrition, it's prospective course of more than 100 European children with short bowel syndrome treated with teduglutide for 2 years. And this study really caught my attention because it gave us some much-needed long-term real-world data on teduglutide in children with short bowel syndrome. We know that teduglutide can help reduce parental nutrition requirements, but families often ask clinicians, including myself, whether these benefits are durable and how quickly can we expect to see a reduction in PN requirements. In this large European study, including 104 children, almost 85% of those who responded within the first year maintained their response at 2 years, and 25% of the initial non-responders achieved response at 24 months. Even more importantly, nearly one-third of all patients achieve complete independence from parental nutrition by 24 months. The study also identified factors associated with PN weaning, including longer residual bowel length, as expected, preservation of the IC valve, higher citrulline levels, and lower baseline PN requirements. This really reinforces the idea that teduglutide can be an effective long-term individualized therapy for children with intestinal failure secondary to short bowel syndrome and has to be discussed with the families as a potential therapeutic option.
The problem being, of course, that they have to hang in there, those families and those doctors, for quite a while, because some children achieved parenteral nutrition independence only during the second year of teduglutide treatment.
Yes, and I think this is a very important message for clinicians, but most importantly for families. Sometimes we expect a rapid response and may become discouraged if a child remains PN dependent or we haven't seen a huge reduction in the requirements after the first year. And this study suggests it's important to persist with the treatment and gives clinicians some data to present to the families which are concerned that we continue with a maybe futile treatment.
Now, you now have a set of anatomical and functional markers associated with better long-term outcome. Is that going to modify clinical practice?
Think markers like residual bowel length, citrulline levels, ICV presence could help us identify which patients are most likely to benefit from teduglutide. These markers are all indicators of intestinal absorptive capacities, as we know. And in the future, they may help maybe personalize treatment decision, counsel families more accurately about prognosis, and potentially even optimize the timing of teduglutide initiation, really.
Fair enough. On to the second abstract, which is titled Personalized Nutritional Strategies to Prevent Postnatal Growth Faltering in Preterm Infants. Growth faltering. When I went to medical school, was that called failure to thrive?
Yes, we still use sometimes the same term.
Okay. I'm an antique shop, what can I tell you? Why did you pick this abstract?
So I'm not a neonatologist, as you know, but I really like this abstract because it challenges our assumption about nutritional requirements in extremely preterm infants. The investigators showed that an individualized nutritional strategy with intensive follow-up and protein intake exceeding current ESPGHAN recommendations, so usually it's around 4.5 grams per kilo per day, but they use 5.5 grams per kilo per day, significantly reduced growth faltering and improved both weight and linear growth without apparent adverse effects.
Now, should we then reconsider current protein recommendations for the extremely preterm infants?
I think this study certainly suggests that one size may not fit all. The most vulnerable infants may require considerably higher protein intake than current recommendations suggest. Of course, larger prospective studies are needed, but this finding may encourage us to adopt a more individualized approach to nutritional support for these babies, I will say.
Early growth faltering. I hope I said that right. Early growth faltering. Why is that so important, Elena?
I think growth during this critical period, it's closely linked to neurodevelopment outcomes and long-term health. And improving growth early in life may have consequences that extend far beyond infancy, potentially influencing, for example, the cognitive development, body composition, and overall health later in childhood and later in life.
Well, we have to pull you away from your favorite subject and move on to just plain gastroenterology. Tough to choose, huh?
Oh, yes, very, always.
Well, the one that you chose is the ambitiously titled Ambition CD, anti-TNF versus ustekinumab. Now, you have to tell me what its name is when you're at home, in biologic-naive pediatric Crohn's disease.
Yes, and I found this study really fascinating because it addresses one of the biggest questions in pediatric IBD right now. Should anti-TNF agents remain our first biologic choice, or could ustekinumab and maybe other biologic treatments be considered an alternative in biologic-naive patients? And this prospective multicenter cohort included more than 250 children with Crohn's disease and found similar outcomes between adalimumab and ustekinumab in terms of steroid-free clinical and endoscopic remission, but with infliximab having better results. In terms of drug durability, anti-TNF performed better, but they don't really know why this has happened. Score analyses are still ongoing. But this finding suggests that ustekinumab could be used as first-line biologic option in selective patients.
At 1 year, they had similar rates of clinical and endoscopic healing?
Yes, compared with infliximab, but not adalimumab, that is the other anti-TNF.
Okay. Well, Do these findings have implications for choices of first-line biologic therapy in pediatric Crohn's?
Potentially, yes, I will say. Until now, anti-TNF agents have been the standard first biologic because we simply lacked comparative pediatric data and they were the only one approved for in children. This study suggests that ustekinumab may achieve similar outcomes, at least compared with adalimumab. In further analysis, if further analysis confirmed these findings, we may move towards a more personalized approach where the choice of biologic is guided by disease phenotype, patient preference, safety consideration, and treatment burden.
I don't think you're ever going to routinely recommend ustekinumab as a first biologic, but what information would you like to have in hand before you recommend it?
Probably I will be interested in longer-term outcomes, particularly sustained remission, growth, mucosal healing, safety over several years. We also need to understand whether certain subgroups, for example, the ones that have perianal disease or severe inflammatory burden, benefit more from one therapy than another.
Well, for you esophagus fans, for you gastric aficionados, sorry, we have another IBD abstract that Elena found fascinating. Outcomes of anti-TNF withdrawal after sustained remission in pediatric IBD. Why'd you pick this one?
I think this study, it's a study that many of us were waiting for, really, because one of the most common questions from families is how long their child has to be on this treatment and whether we can eventually stop it.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, the findings are quite striking in a negative way. More than half of the children relapsed within 1 year of stopping anti-TNF therapy, and a third restarted the biologic treatment. By 2 years, almost 76% had flared, and nearly two-thirds had restarted biologic treatment, which are quite high numbers. Perhaps even more challenging is that the researchers could not identify any reliable predictors of relapse, and maintenance immunomodulator therapy that we usually use did not make a statistically significant difference to avoid flares or restarting the biologic treatment.
Just a question. Once it's been discontinued, do the children respond to it again?
They haven't analyzed this, but it's a very good question, I will say yes.
Sometimes it's harder to... Well. So discussions with families considering he's doing so well, can we stop?
Yes, and I think this data really suggests that stopping treatment carries a very substantial risk of relapse, even in the ones that have been... they haven't had a flare for years. And families should really understand that even children in sustained remission may flare relatively quickly after discontinuation. And this information really can help support shared decision-making and ensure that expectations are realistic before stopping any therapy.
It's really a shame that the study didn't identify any effective predictors, because that would be so useful to have just in terms of signaling prognosis to the families. What do you think?
Exactly. I think at this point in time, we really cannot reliably identify which children can safely discontinue therapy. Even patients who appear to be doing exceptionally well remain at risk. And this highlights the urgent need for better biomarkers, as discussed in the State of Art lecture this year, and more precise tools to guide de-escalation strategies.
Thank you. It's what you've all been waiting for, the hepatology abstracts. Yes! Okay. Elena, last and certainly not the least. Urinary metabolomic profiling predicts native liver survival in biliary atresia. Back to you, Elena.
So, I'm not a hepatologist, as you know, but I know that the course of biliary atresia after Kasai can be very unpredictable. Some infants do very well for years, while others progress rapidly and require liver transplantation. And unfortunately, we still lack reliable tools to identify those high-risk patients early on. In this prospective pilot study, researchers collected urine and blood sample from 19 infants with biliary atresia at the time of Kasai, and then again at 6 weeks and 6 months after surgery. Using metabolomic profiling, they analyzed almost 200 metabolites and compared the findings with infants with other causes of neonatal cholestasis. Interestingly, there was no predictive metabolic signature at diagnosis. However, by 6 weeks after Kasai, infants who later required liver transplantation had a distinct urinary profile characterized by elevated aromatic amino acids acylcarnitines and kynurenine. By 6 months, these metabolomic disturbances become even more pronounced. The study also identified an association with Claudin-3, a marker of epithelial barrier integrity that has recently been linked to poorer outcomes in biliary atresia. Overall, this study suggests that a simple, non-invasive urine test may one day help us identify infants at higher risk of losing their native liver much earlier in the disease course.
Well, very well, but what are you going to do once you have this red flag saying Johnny's not doing well?
I think you've validated, because that is the first step anyway. This approach could allow us to identify high-risk infants much earlier. Rather than waiting for clinical deterioration, we could potentially intensify monitoring, optimize supportive care, and even consider earlier referral for transplantation assessment. But anyway, you are the expert in liver. What is your opinion?
Oh, listen to you. And you remember the biblical story of Ananias and Sapphira, the ones whom God struck dead for lying? Watch it. I'm not an expert in liver. I really am not. This sounds lovely, and yet, you think that this is really going to pick up these kids before other clinical markers?
I hope so, and I'm sure the researcher thought the same.
Yeah, and how do we tie Claudin-3 into all of this?
Claudin-3, we know it's involved in epithelial barrier integrity and has already emerged as a potential biomarker in biliary atresia. The fact that it was associated with these metabolomic changes suggests that there may be important links between intestinal barrier dysfunction, metabolic pathways, and disease progression, opening, I think, entirely new avenues for research, really.
Well, Claudin-3 is a component of the tight junction, yeah?
Yes.
So here you have a child in whom biliary outflow is incompletely relieved, simply a mechanical disturbance there, somewhere at the porta hepatis. And bile is backing up. Bile is lysing bile ducts. Bile is releasing Claudin-3 into the plasma, along with refluxed bile. I don't know, but if I were reviewing this, I'd say, what other tight junction components did you look at?
I think we have to ask the researcher this question.
Okay.
I will go back to that.
Number six, long-term outcomes of pediatric donation after circulatory death liver transplantation. Circulatory death liver transplantation. Nobody uses the word cadaveric anymore. Oh, well.
This study, I think, addresses a very important issue in pediatric transplantation, expanding the donor pool. Concerns about higher rates of complication existed, and long-term outcomes of DCD liver transplantation in children have remained uncertain. In this study, researchers analyzed data from 133 children across 19 European centers who received a DCD liver transplant, making this the largest pediatric DCD cohort reported to date. The results were really reassuring, I will say. Overall survival was excellent, reaching 90% at 1 year and 87% at 10 years, with outcomes improving over time. Interestingly, children who received full-size graft had significantly better survival than those who received technical variant graft. The main causes of mortality were liver-related complications and infections. Overall, these findings suggest that carefully selected DCD grafts can safely increase organ availability for children requiring liver transplantation while still providing excellent long-term outcomes.
But these are from adults or from children?
Children.
No, the livers were from children.
Oh, they haven't said that in the...
I think that's important because a standard method of increasing the number of kids you can transplant is to split the liver. And that, of course, counts as a non-standard graft, doesn't it?
Yes.
So, are we losing on the roundabouts? What we're picking up on the swings, in terms of not being able to split an adult liver, are we setting a kid up for a bad outcome?
I think the results are reassuring, and we know that selective DCD grafts can significantly expand organ availability without compromising the outcomes. And given the persistent shortage of donor organs, this could potentially reduce waiting list mortality and increase transplantation opportunities for children. But thinking of the other, why the difference in between technical variant, I imagine these technical variant grafts are often surgically more complex and may be associated with higher risk of vascular and biliary complication. And understanding these differences may help define what donor selection and optimize surgical strategies to improve outcomes further. But
it sounds as if we're on the same page, and that if you can use a whole liver allograft, you're better off. And you have to weigh that against the fact that an adult whole liver allograft, well, it won't fit into a kid, first thing. And the second is that you can get two livers out of that.
True.
Well, anything else you'd like to share with us about the conference?
What I said, it was really an amazing meeting, and the networking was very good. Seeing you all from the podcast team was amazing. And yeah, it was a great conference in France. And I think we're going to go for the song, isn't it?
Well, let me just say, could we sum it up then as, regarding this conference, you regret nothing?
I will not regret that.
You regret?
I will not.
Vous regrettez rien?
Oh, maybe, yes. Edith Piaf, isn't it?
So tell us about your song.
So we're going to go for Edith Piaf's song.
Rien de rien?
Rien de rien.
Thank you.
Thank you.